Michael Green, the Clerk of Green's List, and welcome and thanks very much for taking the trouble to be here this morning. This morning our presenter is Belinda Cohen, and I'll give you a little bit of background on Belinda in a moment. Our point this morning is business skills and practice management, one of the non-substantive law compulsory points. The agenda or the way we run the morning will be the same as we usually do, with Belinda presenting for about half an hour, then a 10-minute break, then a further half hour. A little bit about Belinda. Belinda's the director of Inspired Reality, which is her business. She comes to the coaching and training business with actually a strong background in the law. She is a lawyer. She worked for, I forget how long, but for quite a while as a manager at TAC and in the private profession in litigation, the whole time, I think, was in litigation. So about 10 years or so ago, Belinda decided to move away from law into the coaching and training field, and that's what she's done, and she's run her own business in that field for the last 10 years or so. What she does in that business is coach and train staff and management of legal firms to multinational companies in improving workplace and business performance. I'll just run off some of Belinda's clients here, they're pretty impressive. NAB, Crown, Justice Department here in Victoria, the TAC, Department of Premier and Cabinet, Australia Post, Comcare, South East Water, and here at the Victorian Bar. In fact, the readers who are going to be here in a few minutes, or in 8:45, Belinda does business plans with those readers. The bar's engaged Belinda to do that. She also has been a judge for the Telstra Business Award since 2009. So please welcome Belinda Cohen to speak on social intelligence.
Thanks very much, Michael, for having me back today. And thank you all to you very much for getting up so early in the morning. I do appreciate it. I am a morning person, but I know sometimes if you're late night, as I did last night, or you're not a morning person, this can be a stretch. So a big congratulations to you who have stretched yourselves this morning in coming here so early. I am going to be talking to you about the topic of social intelligence this morning, and it may not be a topic that is something that you're overly familiar with, but it is my intention for you this morning that by the end of my presentation you will know why it is so important and hopefully consider how you might go and implement some of the principles and concepts that I'm talking about today in your work. There are a number of different kinds of intelligence that we apply in a work context, and I'll take you through those. And what I'm going to share with you this morning comes from a new field of research which is called social neuroscience, and that study of research is a combination of psychology and neuroscience. Now, unfortunately, as a result of attending my presentation this morning, you're not going to walk out of here with increased emotional intelligence or social intelligence. However, I am hoping that you will be suitably motivated to think about how you will apply it for yourselves. So let's look at how intelligent are you. Let's have a think about your level of intelligence in the context of your work. So firstly, we're all familiar with the concept of IQ, and this is the quantitative measure of our intellect, and it's been used for many, many years in a work context to determine perhaps how smart someone is and whether or not they're going to be capable of undertaking a particular job or role. What they've found through the research, however, is that there is a very low correlation between IQ and the ability for someone to perform in their job or how well they will perform. So a high IQ does not necessarily indicate that a person will be successful in their chosen career. It involves grades and standardized test scores, and more importantly, it actually stays static throughout our lifetime. So if you go and have an IQ test and you're not happy with your score, I apologise about that. There's not good news for you in that regard. However, stay calm, because the other levels of intelligence that I'm going to talk about are far more important, and they are changeable. It's interesting that Harvard University actually did a study to map this. And what they found was that the IQ scores were only predictive of a person's performance in the first year of their university degree, but did not map further into their career success in the longer term. So really, IQ is really a measure for entering the game. And I think it would be fair to say that if we look at a legal context, that a person's IQ would have to be at a certain level in order to be able to participate and undertake the intellectual rigour that is required for a legal career. So it's really an entry point. So what we're really more interested in is the emotional intelligence sector of your intelligence, and this is really around self-mastery. So it is, what is it that you understand about how you perform, how you handle yourself, and your individual abilities. And the great news about EQ is that it can be enhanced over time. And for those of you who are older, and I'm older, it's something that is actually demonstrated to increase as we age, as we gain more life experience. And they did studies at the Centre of Creative Leadership, and what they found that was that of those executives that who failed in their executive roles, the majority of them failed as a result of lack of emotional intelligence. So their ability to interact with other people and to manage their own emotions. And so when we talk about emotional intelligence, what we're really talking about is ourself. So how do I perceive myself? How do I interact with other people? And also, how do I regulate my emotion in a particular work context? So how is social intelligence different? Well, what social intelligence is actually it's a subset of emotional intelligence. So we have a number of competencies that are required to be perceived as someone who has a high level of emotional intelligence. And the social intelligence skills are a subset of that. And I'll show you a diagram which demonstrates that shortly. But what it is, it's really about the ability of you to interact with other people and have successful interactions with other people. So it's where you take your emotional intelligence competencies and translate them into the world in terms of how you interact with other people and the success of those interactions or not. And in fact, Daniel Goleman, who is well known for popularising the emotional intelligence skill set, although he didn't create it, he says that this is actually the most important component in all of his research, and in 10 years of research, he has had this confirmed overwhelmingly, that this is the distinguishing point for people in terms of whether they are successful or not in their chosen profession. There was an American Management Association that found that the ability to get along with people was more vital than intelligence, decisiveness, knowledge, or job skills in producing good leaders. So very, very important skill set. And there have been a number of studies which shown a direct correlation between this skill set and the bottom line in terms of what an organisation produces and the need for socially intelligent leaders in an organisation. So how is this important in a legal context? Well, in a legal context, we deal with people every single day. And therefore our ability to be able to relate well to our clients and the numerous other stakeholders that you will encounter through the course of a day-to-day legal practice is fundamental in terms of how successful you will be. And I will demonstrate to you later on how, on a global scale, this is being looked at very seriously and how the curriculums in universities are changing as a result. So I thought I'd kick off in grounding some of this information by sharing with you a case study of some research that was done. And there was a gentleman who's known as Antonio Damasio, and what his major skill set was is understanding the circuitry in the front part of your brain known as the prefrontal cortex. And this is where your working memory occurs, when you have your intelligent thinking, when you have your reasoning. All of this comes out of your prefrontal cortex. And he was asked to treat a very, very bright corporate lawyer who had had a prefrontal brain tumour. And the tumour was operated on quite successfully and very, very early. And for all intents and purposes, the surgery was perceived to be successful. However, they had snipped the connection between the amygdala, which is the emotional centre in our brain, and the brief prefrontal cortex. And I'm going to talk to you a little bit more about the amygdala's function later on. So he'd had this snip occur. So he's going about his work and his daily life after the surgery, and for all intents and purposes, he felt that he had recovered well from the surgery. However, slowly over time, this gentleman's life began to unravel. His wife left him, he lost his job, he lost his house, and at the time that he came to see the doctor, he was actually living in his brother's home in a spare room. So he really was in quite a bad way, even though for all perceptions, that it had been a successful outcome to the surgery. So Damasio, doing the things that he does as an expert, put this gentleman through a number of rigorous tests, neuropsychological tests, and found that they, in fact, he did very, very well on all of those tests, and they were quite stumped as to what had occurred with this gentleman, until he asked him this question, which is, when should we have our next appointment? And the lawyer was unable to answer this question. He was able to elicit all of the logical reasons why Tuesday is a good day, Thursday is a bad day, etc., etc., but he was unable to determine which was the better choice. That was because the ability to make that decision is linked to the emotional centres in our brain, and also a lower part of the brain called the basal ganglia. And what the basal ganglia does is it stores all of the events and past history that you have accumulated over time, so that when you reference in, was that a good decision or was that a bad decision, the basal ganglia helps you to make that decision by saying, well, last time I endeavoured to cross the road in front of a vehicle, I nearly got hit, so perhaps that's not a good idea this time. So it's all of that storage of memory that it brings to bear in order to inform our decision. Now, the basal ganglia sits at the bottom of the brain, and our brain is actually developed from the base up. And so therefore, it is not very advanced in terms of how it communicates with the verbal parts of our brain. So we don't get messages from our basal ganglia in terms of thoughts that we can understand in terms of the internal dialogue in our head. They come through the emotional centres as feeling, and they're also very strongly connected to the gut. And so when we have that, when we talk about the concept of a gut instinct, it is as a result of the thoughts that are triggered from the basal ganglia in our brain. So therefore, this was the interesting dynamic that was occurring with this lawyer, and highlights how important these emotional centres in our brain are in our everyday functioning. So if we look at emotional intelligence and the breakdown, we can see that there's five major competencies for emotional intelligence. We have self-awareness, which is our ability to understand who we are and how we are perceived by other people, and to make modifications as a result of that through self-regulation. So whether we, how we approach people, how we communicate. Our motivation, which are our internal drivers, is also an important part of our emotional intelligence skill set. But the social intelligence skills relate to the ability to have empathy for other people and our interactions in terms of our social skills. And these, actually, within this subset here, there are eight further subsets of skills, which I'm going to take you through a little bit later on. So really, social intelligence is about our ability to get along with others and to get them to cooperate with you. And if you think about your daily working lives, everything you achieve in life is with or through other people. Now stop and think about that. Think about your journey into the law. Think about what you're about to embark on today. If no one else showed up, how well would you do? Or would you have anything to do if there was no one else around? So everything we do is with or through other people, and the success of your endeavours is very, very strongly linked to how successfully you interact with other people in those contexts. Now, there are two parts of our brain which are quite important over and above the ones I've already mentioned in terms of our social interaction skills. And the first one of these is what's known as the motor neuron, the mirror neuron, sorry. And the mirror neurons were discovered more recently through some studies of some monkeys. And what they were doing was they were getting these monkeys to lift things with their arms. So whether it be have a glass of drink, I think they were eating food. And they would watch how the mirror neuron in the brain was triggered every time this monkey picked up the banana, say for example. So the monkey picked up the banana and a neuron in the brain fired. And then what they observed was that another researcher walked into the room and the monkey's neuron fired. And they couldn't understand what was going on until they turned around and noticed that the researcher was eating and lifting their arm to their mouth in the same way that the monkey had been previously. So what in fact they discovered was that our mirror neurons in our brain fire when we not only experience something, but when we see somebody else doing something that we have had an experience of. So you can think now of perhaps funniest home videos where we see someone crash and we cringe and we have an emotional response to something that we witness. That is a result of the mirror neurons firing in our brain. So we are actually wired for social connectivity in our brain and to enhance our ability to interact with people and have that empathy. Now it's interesting In previous discussions and conversations that I've had around this topic, some people say, oh, you know what, women are better at that than men. And it's interesting to note that there is no gender difference as far as it's concerned. So that in fact that they have demonstrated that it is quite similar across gender, that for the there are equal numbers of empathetic men as there are empathetic women, and there are equal numbers of non-empathetic men and non-empathetic women. And you may have observed some of those in your working lives. So it's interesting that the mirror neurons have been very, very important in terms of us building our skills around language and social communication in order to improve how we interact with other people. So this part of your brain is really the one that I think gets most people unstuck in the context of social intelligence. And it's known as the amygdala. And the amygdala, what it does is it is really the center for our basic survival. So it's like your threat radar. So it goes around and scanning the environment. Is there a threat? Is there a threat? Is there a threat? What the amygdala basically was serving us to do way back when we were running around trying to keep ourselves safe from lions in the savannah was to trigger a whole range of complex chemical events in our body to enable us to survive. So what it does is it increases our heart rate, it pumps blood into our extremities in order for us to be able to run away from an impending threat, being a lion or whatever it is, when we were out being cavemen. However, in this day and age, as far as I know, unless you're working in a zoo or perhaps the poor lady who was squashed by the elephant last week, there are no physical threats such as that we are encountering on a day-to-day basis in our working lives. So what we're actually dealing with now are what's known as conceptual threats. They are things that I perceive in my own mind to be threats based on whatever it is that I'm focused on in the time and the experiences that I'm having. So it may be that if you're in a court, it may be that it's something that your opponent is arguing, you perceive as a conceptual threat, and therefore you get the increase. Heart rate, the cortisol levels increase in your body, and therefore all of these events are going on and you're having this threat response. So what does the amygdala do? The amygdala is the emotional center. So what it does is it acts a lot faster than other parts of your brain. So information will come into your brain and it hits the amygdala first. So if you can imagine that there's a fork in the road, it comes off, it hits the amygdala, and the information continues beyond the amygdala round to the prefrontal cortex, which, as I explained earlier, is your working memory and the thinking part of your brain. Now, the amygdala is not very accurate, so if it sees something that in the past you had an event, say if you have a fear of spiders would be an example, and I see a dot on the wall that could potentially be a spider, I may automatically assume it's a spider because that's what the amygdala does. I'm here, it's a threat, it's a spider, I've got to get out of here, I'm scared of spiders, and it will trigger the response. However, if we allow the brain to continue its functioning and get to the prefrontal cortex, we then have the rational part of our brain kick in, which then takes a few steps closer to the wall to see that it's just a black smudge mark on the wall and in fact there is no threat. But what happens in our daily lives is a lot of people are reliant on that first response and they don't take the time to think and slow themselves down to determine whether it is a real threat or not. And therefore, amygdala, what they call amygdala hijacks, trigger large and strong emotional responses so that you'll see people shoot from the hip, be quite emotive in their responses, and then think later, oh, maybe I shouldn't have done that. So the regrets that you may have experienced in your lifetime, if you have had an experience where you shot from the hip and said something and then regretted it later, you had just been the victim of an amygdala hijack. So the key is to actually have some awareness of that going on in your lifetime and also in the context of interactions with other people. Because if I'm wanting to be a socially intelligent person and have positive relationships in my working life, I don't want to be subjected to amygdala hijacks because they're going to have a detrimental effect upon how people perceive me, how I interact with people, and my ability to influence other people more broadly in my working life. And we'll talk a little bit more about why that is so important. Is there any questions about anything that I've discussed so far? No. Excellent, so let's look at social intelligence in action. All right, I mentioned before that there are eight social intelligence competencies that exist within this subset. Now you'll see that there we've got the blue competencies, and probably better to refer to your notes rather than try and see the screen all the way back from the back there. But the blue competencies is the ability to connect with and know what it is that other people are feeling. And this is a finely honed skill. And in our population, there are a percentage of people who focus very, very much on what we call body language and broader communication filters. So it may be body language, tonality, as well as the words that are used in communication. But there are also a percentage of you that don't. And in the legal profession, you're in fact skewed probably more in the other direction in some spheres, particularly if you have a role which is very much focused on analysing the words. Because for that kind of person, the words will matter more than the broader communication and any emotional communication or body language or any of those other things that occur than just the words. So these are the kinds of people who will nitpick you on your words and say, did you really mean that word when you said it? And you're like, I was just broadly speaking about what I was speaking and wasn't really thinking about the specificity of the words, but for them that is very, very important. Now for those kinds of people, the ability to implement these social awareness skills can be more tricky because it relies much more on being able to connect with and read those non-verbal communication skills. So it really starts with primal empathy, and that is the ability to have empathy for somebody else's situation. Now, empathy is the ability to connect with the emotion, but it's not like feeling sorry for someone, it's just the ability to understand and relate to a particular emotion. So it's about sensing those non-verbal cues and having that gut instinct about how someone might be feeling in the moment. And then it's about attunement, and that is about active listening. So it's really then asking questions of that person about what it is that they might be feeling and clarifying that. And that then leads up to the empathetic accuracy, because we do this amazing thing, and I see this all the time with my clients, where we just assume that we know what someone else is feeling and we don't test it. So it may be that I've had clients who've said to me, I really don't think that the people I work with like me. And I say, how do you know that? Oh, well, I just know. Well, what have you relied on? What evidence have you got to confirm that? Well, last week, Sally was working at her computer and I went to ask her a question and she ignored me. And so then I actually pushed clients to go back and explore these things. And I said, okay, what else was going on around at that particular time? Oh, we were extremely busy. There was a lot going on. Oh yeah, now that I remember it, yes, Sally had said to me she had a deadline that morning, and so on and so forth. But because they're bringing to bear their own insecurities or thoughts about themselves, they will mind read what someone else is thinking. So hence, this skill set is really, really important in terms of developing the accuracy and the understanding of what someone is thinking, as opposed to the guesswork that we might sometimes apply in a hurry. And the active listening and that presence is really about how do you make someone feel valued when you're interacting with them? How do they know that you're actually 100% present for them, as opposed to checking your mobile phone whilst talking to them, which is a disease that we have very commonly these days. And I heard yesterday there's actually a classified phobia of fear of being out of contact with a mobile phone, which is extraordinary, something we didn't have a long time ago. So it's about a person knowing that you're actually present for them and really listening to what they have to say, and that'll be confirmed through the comments that you feed back in terms of how you respond to their communication. And then there's a thing known as social cognition, and that is really about having an understanding of the broader social landscape. And so in an organisational context, this would be the thing that we would refer to as office politics. It can be traditionalist environments. So in the work that I've been doing with the readers over the last few weeks, we've been talking about some of the constructs and cultural norms that exist within the bar and how they may or may not be of assistance in terms of a person growing their practice. So, but having an understanding of those social constructs and what that means for you in terms of how you operate and how you interact with other people. For example, if I was lacking in social cognition, I might show up this morning in my pajamas and think that that's perfectly okay, because I'm not giving consideration to the social context or the fact that presenting in your pyjamas is perhaps not an okay thing to do. So it's all of this mixed together that is very, very important in terms of our social awareness and our social effectiveness. And then we move through to what we know as social facility. And this is, once I have that social awareness, how do I facilitate that through my actions? And the first thing is what we call as synchrony, or what I refer to as rapport building. And it's really that dance that we do with other people in terms of our body language and our words in how we communicate. And if you've got some friends that you regularly hang out with, you will have words that you use that are similar, you'll have ways of interacting with your bodies, whether you've noticed it or not, go back and check next time you're with them, which is like a dance where your body, these mirror neurons connect, and there is a dance of rapport. So I could sit here and pull someone out of the audience and I could actively build rapport with them using my physical body by perhaps aligning my body angle, crossing my legs the same way, etc. Now you all do this, you're mortified now, unconsciously. It's something that you do very, very unconsciously. And equally, if you are falling out of that rhythm, you break rapport. So if you've been in a negotiation, for example, and things have been going well, but then all of a sudden someone sits back in their chair and goes like this, all of a sudden you feel the wall go up. And it can be something that people very actively use as a way of impacting communication, is to use their body as a way of shifting the dynamic or the synchrony of the communication. So understanding the importance of that skill set is paramount. The next is self-presentation, and I spoke just before about presenting in my pyjamas. And so understanding, well, what is the image or the perception that you want people to have of you? What are the words that you want them to attribute to you as a professional person? And how do you communicate that through everything that you do? How do you facilitate that through how you speak, how you interact, and how you connect with other people? Charisma falls very much into this category, and people who have a lot of connectivity to other people will be described as being charismatic. And there are actually language patterns for people who are charismatic that they've studied through studying speeches of great leaders over time. And what they do is they focus on the emotions first in the conversation. They will talk all about the feelings of, you know, let's feel about this. You think, listen to the I Have a Dream speech, there's emphasis of it in there, some of JFK's speeches. But they talk about the emotion, and then they use auditory words which describe things, and then they create a vision, which is the visual. So it's actually moving through your neurology. So it's building up the emotion and coming through up to the vision space, which is, I want you to now see this creation that we are going to fulfill. So with Obama, it might have been in the last election, yes, we can. So getting people to see that, yes, we can, but he's built the emotion before he gets to that point. So it's also the ability to control and mask your emotions as appropriate. So there are times when it is not appropriate to yell out. And the best way to see this is to see children. And I attended my daughter's assembly on Monday morning, and it was interesting. It's a very formal occasion, and it's interesting to watch her principal. And she has a new principal, so he's obviously trying to establish what his social facility will be with this group. And so he used mirror neurons. And so what he did is he's created this thing where, to get everyone's attention, he puts his hands up. And the students are required to also put their hands up. So he's connecting that mirror neuron and creating rapport in that event. But then, what he also does is he emphasised through his words that this is a formal occasion, and this was an opportunity, because there's parents who come, to demonstrate our school community and what a positive school community this is. Now he came a bit unstuck when one of the students had prepared a presentation around some particular topic that was occurring for the school and happened to put the soundtrack for Gangnam Style in the background as the soundtrack. And all of a sudden you had this whole group of children in the thing going like this, sitting in their seats, which was completely not aligned with what perhaps he was attending, but incredibly funny to watch. But having good rapport, he utilised that. And he said to the children that he could see that that was something that they really enjoyed and that perhaps they might want to consider having a Gangnam Style dance-off towards the latter part of the year, to which they all resounded in huge cheers. So his social facility was working very well for him in continuing to build rapport with his student group. Influence. I think in terms of my executive coaching work, this is the area that I'm probably asked to work in with every single engagement, is how do I become more influential in my environment? And it is utilising a combination of these skills. It's having the ability to have that social awareness that we spoke about earlier, to have the attunement, to listen to what it is that is important to other people, and then to be able to frame whatever it is that you're aiming to achieve in a way that connects with that audience and therefore can influence the outcome in a positive way. But these are all very much social intelligence skills, which also draws on the need to have empathy. And particularly if you come from contrasting views, that can be more challenging to be able to put yourself in someone else's shoes and perhaps consider a perspective. But if you are negotiating, this is an incredibly valuable skill set if you can work with this effectively. And then finally is concern, and that's about caring about the needs of others and acting with compassion. And compassion, it's interesting when I ask people about their perspectives of compassion, some people are not really sure about, well, what is compassion? Is it about the fact that I feel sorry for you and I do what I can to make you feel right or make you improve your situation? That's in fact being a rescuer, and it's not helpful, and it's not acting with compassion, because compassion is all about empowerment, and it's all about facilitating a person's ability to resolve a problem for themselves. Now, there may be tools and information that you may be able to guide to someone to do that, but compassion is all about that self-action and being able to assist a person to take that action for themselves. So, I want to play a bit of a game show, imagine your music, get your music, come on down, Alan Jones. And I'm very grateful. I'd like to publicly acknowledge Alan for being my subject for today's conversation. Very gracious of him to have provided the perfect playground for me to discuss the topic of social intelligence with you today. Is there anyone who is unfamiliar with what has been occurring with Alan Jones over recent weeks and his faux pas with the Prime Minister? Just so I don't have anyone who's in the context. So,
you may use the word faux pas, it's meaningless, cruel.
There you go. So the thing is, and that's great feedback, because he obviously didn't get that. So if we take the example of his comments about the Prime Minister, and we benchmark against which of the social intelligence competencies he failed to apply, we find that there are numerous. But there's also an interesting dichotomy, which came up through a discussion I was having with another group of lawyers, which I think is very relevant. So primal empathy, that ability to have feeling with others. Clearly when he made the comment about the Prime Minister during the time of grief about her father, he was demonstrating no primal empathy at all. Had no consideration of how she might be feeling at a particular time, and it's only been a short period since the death of her father. And therefore that pretty much throws out all the rest of it. But interestingly enough, when we look at social cognition, it's arguable that he did have social cognition in play. Now, why would that be?
The context in which he said it, that people were talking.
Exactly. So he was endeavouring to be in synchrony with the audience that he was presenting to. In making a negative comment about the Prime Minister, he was endeavouring to build rapport with the Liberal audience that he was engaged to speak with. What he failed to do, though, was to look at the broader context outside the subcontext in which he was presenting, and the sponsors and the potential response of people outside of that room to the comment that he made. He therefore has had an impact upon his self-presentation in terms of his reputation, and we saw all of the flow-on effects in terms of the impact of his sponsorship. And it's interesting, some would argue that his influence has been diminished, others would say not. Potentially, his branding is all about that ability to shock and be indifferent to people. I think to be in a role such as him, to some extent, you have to be a bit Teflon to barbs that are thrown at you in order to sustain that role over time. But equally, in having that frame of people can say whatever they like and I don't care because there's rules for me and there's rules for all of the rest of you, it means that he, if he gets caught into this way of thinking, that then he will fail to connect with the primal empathy, and therefore, which is one of the primary ways in which we connect with other people, and concern, I think, pretty much speaks for itself. So Ellen provides a very good subject matter for analysing these competencies and seeing the impact of what occurs when in fact we breach these social intelligence competencies and in fact the devastating impact that it can potentially have on a person's business. So I want to tie this conversation up by talking about, well, this is all very well and good, and I understand that these are good competencies, and so maybe now, and we've been talking about these things as soft skills for many, many years when we talk about capabilities and competencies and learning environments. If I'm going to go out and do a training about leadership, whatever it is, I'm going off to do soft skills training. And when I hear that word, I almost cringe, because the hard science demonstrates that these things are not soft skills, they are hard skills that we need to work very actively to hardwire. So I would disagree with that comment. So I want to consider why it is that these skills are so impactful in the context of a legal practice. Now here's some sad statistics around EQ and lawyers, of which social intelligence is included in that subset. And I think it'd be fair to say that emotions are not something, they definitely occur within legal practice. I've been at the tail end of some very emotional opponents over my time in my legal career. So it's not to say that the profession is devoid of emotion, but certainly in many contexts, emotion is seen as a sign of weakness and perhaps not something that is appropriate for someone operating in the legal profession. So therefore, perhaps undervalued on a broader cultural scale. And some people who have a very strong analytical frame may think, well, I've been successful enough just with my approach, which doesn't involve a lot of emotion, so therefore why do I even need to care about any of these social skills? And particularly in terms of the bar, I get a lot of feedback from solicitors saying, well, that's something you could teach the barristers, and we have that construct of the barrister who sits alone in their chambers and is an expert in their field, but when you come to speak to them, is lacking a lot of these social intelligence skills. It'll be the senior counsel that once referred to me as Dearie across the bar table, which didn't really enamour me very much towards him, and I never briefed him again. So they're very, very important. And it's interesting the comments of the Dean of Harvard Law School, and back in 1955, he was very much advocating for human relations training in law schools, saying that the average lawyer spent far more time interacting with other people than they did in reading legal cases and writing advices. So the other thing is there's obviously the reputational impact that has upon you as a professional in the law, but it also has an impact upon the profession in terms of the high levels of anxiety and depression and alcohol intake, etc., that we know is a very real problem within the profession. And this really comes out of that failure to have concern for ourselves and concern for others in a way that is appropriate, and having that self-awareness to understand what is it that I need to be doing now to take care of myself and continue to operate effectively. And there's a real-time cost to business as a result of those depressive illnesses. So there's a lot going on in the world around this area of study and impacts upon law school curriculums as a result. There was a social psychologist called Tom Tyler, and he did a study of divorce law cases, and he spoke to clients about what it was that really mattered to them. And lawyers thought it was all about the outcome and the quantum, but in fact what mattered to these clients most was how they were treated through the process. So it was all about their experience of the process over and above the quantum that was achieved in the outcome. Accepting that people in divorce cases, for the most part, are already in a pretty emotional state anyway. And it's interesting that Berkeley in the US now runs a course called Skills of Exceptional Lawyers, Social Intelligence and Human Dimension, and these are the things that you will study in this course. Reading people, building trust, improving judgment, enhancing creativity, managing people, time in your career, being organised, dealing with stress, having fun and being successful. Social intelligence studies show everyone can get better at these skills. In the UK, they did a study of a number of clients in terms of their experience with their legal practitioners. And through this study, they found that over 50% of these people surveyed worked with a lawyer that they did not like, which would assume that they, again, were lacking in their social intelligence skills and that they had failed to build rapport with their client base. As a result of that, there's been changes to the UK curriculum where they've in fact now added course studies relating to client relationship management and client interviewing skills. And these skills that they focus on are particularly focused on rapport building and active listening to clients. So we're seeing positive changes over in the UK. An interesting study comes from LawCover here in Australia, and they did a study of the professional indemnity risk that they had, and they went back and looked at over 2,000 cases that they'd had of claims being brought against lawyers, and they described the results as clearly disturbing, showing how easy it was for the average lawyer, and this is even lawyers that you or I would be happy to recommend to a client, would become entangled in events that led to a claim. And what they found that was the lawyers didn't seem to understand the dynamics of how the claims had emerged. But in fact, the most significant cause of professional negligence claims was not dissatisfaction with an outcome, but it was related to the handling of the client relationship, which again came down to failure to listen and to the client and ask appropriate questions. And they did an additional study of accredited specialists and found the same results. So we can see then how these social intelligence skills are important in ensuring that you don't fall foul of your professional liabilities. And going back to the emotional management of the profession, we can see that the lack of our ability to have primal empathy and concern for each other is part of the driver of these very staggering statistics about depression in the profession, which not only comes as a personal cost to the profession because we lose talent as a result of these illnesses, productivity is lost as a result of these illnesses, but of course it also impacts the bottom line. So my takeaway thoughts for you are this, and a member of our audience today just had a conversation with me about the importance of how they exercise their body, and equally it's important to exercise our brain, and I couldn't agree more. Your brain is something which can be worked on and developed on an ongoing basis and improved. Norman Doidge is the most well-known person in this field for talking about the concept of neuroplasticity. And neuroplasticity is the concept that our brain is constantly changing and evolving until the day that we die. Just as we can increase a muscle in our bicep, we can also increase the connectivity in our brain and expand how we operate and become more effective. Now, there are things that influenced the neural pathways that we have in our brain. Culture will have an impact, so the culture of wherever you are will impact what you're choosing to focus on, and therefore whether or not you are choosing to develop in one area or another. And also your role will have the specificity of your role will be important as well. But the neuroplasticity, and we've got these little guys here, they're saying best friends forever, but really in your brain it's just for now. So, and a really basic example of this is if I brush my teeth every day with my right hand, I can tomorrow turn around and start trying to do it with my left hand. Now, I will not be very proficient in the early days while my brain's going, hang on, I usually go down this pathway from A to B to C to D to help you to brush your teeth. But now you're asking me to go somewhere else. And so the brain then has to map a new neural pathway in order to do this. So we get from A to B and it's like, oh, hang on, we've got a different hand here. So now I've got to dig another pathway in the brain in order to allow you to start doing things in a different way. And I think one of the most impactful studies that I read in Norman Doidge's book was about a stroke victim who was endeavouring to gain mobility in one side of their body. And so what they did was they inhibited the mobility on the other side of their body to force the brain to reconnect neural pathways in the damaged area to get it to then start moving the other side of the body. So there is incredible science around this, and it's very well established that we have the ability to change the way we think, to change the way we act. For me as a coach, I'm saying hallelujah, because I've been saying this for a long time, but now I have, for my perhaps more doubting clients, the science to support this, for people for whom evidence base is very, very important, that in fact it really is a matter of choice as to how we want to operate, and particularly in the area of these social skills, which are well established as being a very strong link to your success, that in fact you do have choice to create new neural pathways and new ways of behaving and responding in a particular environment. Now, is it going to be easy? Not necessarily so in the first instance. Anyone who's tried to give up something will attest to that. I had to give up chocolate recently. Now, that was pretty much all I had left in my repertoire of things that might be considered sins. But the whole concept of 21 days to break a habit is not just about that repetition for repetition's sake. It's about the fact that your brain is building that new neural pathway to support you in being successful in that new endeavor. So what does this mean for you? It's never stop learning, never stop growing, never stop looking for new experiences. And we see people who perhaps retire and they don't have a purpose beyond that soon die because they're not engaging themselves in that growing. And in fact, they've shown studies that if you don't actively continue to use your brain, that your brain starts to atrophy and shrink. So you need to go and add something new. I don't care what it is, but something new on a regular basis in order to keep those neural pathways growing over time and assisting you in your performance. So my challenge to each and every one of you here today is, how do you rate? If you were to walk away here today, I want you to choose one area that you think that you could improve slightly in terms of your social intelligence. When I work with clients in a coaching context, the first thing that we work with are their strengths. So if you have a strength in this area and you say, well, you know what, I'm actually a very good listener and I've had that feedback from other people, then perhaps continue to work on how can you hone that further. And then once you've identified an area where you think that you could improve, then take active time to work out how you're going to improve and actively seek feedback on one of these other competencies. So I hope that I have given you food for thought this morning in terms of the importance of social intelligence in your practices. And I wish you well with all your future relationships, because they now will be greatly improved because you have all the tools that you need in order to improve how you interact with other people and become more highly social intelligent. Thank you very much for your time.
I would like to thank you, Linda Barb, everybody. I thought it was extremely stimulating, extremely interesting. It's got some personal applications for me, the neuroplasticity. I've got a granddaughter who they're working in that area with because of some learning difficulties. So I've been reading a bit in that area myself in recent times, and it's fascinating and it is interesting how our brains are capable of changing and can be rewired. So it's a great value, I think, to all of us to listen and to learn from what Belinda said this morning. Again, please thank Belinda.